Chapter 9. The China Game. One of Johnson Carter's biggest accounts was a billion-dollar distributor that supplied some of the largest supermarket chains in the United States. ShopCorp wanted us to manufacture the Johnson Carter product line using its company brand in what was called a private label campaign. The project was just getting off the ground when I received a note from Janet, a member of the buying team at ShopCorp. She reviewed different kinds of products, but was less familiar with health and beauty care merchandise. She said that she had discovered a problem with the line that we had created for their company, and she wanted to discuss the issue with me. The ingredients listed on the back of your shampoo, liquid soap, and bubble bath are all identical, she said. That's because they are all the same formulation, I said. That can't be right, she said. She insisted that it must be an error, and she asked me to look into the case. I didn't need to check. I already knew that they were the same. We were not the only company that did this sort of thing. Some successful U.S. companies in health and beauty care also marketed products under different labels, and more than one well-known brand advertised a 3-in-1 formulation right on the package. It was an eye-opener that Janet could not imagine our products shared formulations, but then Bernie surprised me by saying that he didn't know about it either. He had a quick solution to the problem in any event. Rather than try to convince Janet at ShopCorp how our business worked, he suggested that we tweak the ingredients lists so that they differed slightly. It would be easier and safer than challenging Janet, he said. ShopCorp was in the position of control. They sent us orders. They made the decision whether to buy from Johnson Carter. In the spirit of the customer is always right, Bernie figured, if ShopCorp believed that ingredients lists ought to vary because it seemed that they ought to, who were we to say otherwise? Not that anyone at Johnson Carter knew much about the health and beauty care industry either. One day, I received a note about a baby shampoo that we were trying to create for a major drugstore chain. We were formulating what they called a national brand equivalent, essentially a copy of a Johnson & Johnson product, their world-famous baby shampoo. It was going to be one of those products that came in a generic package, but that looked like J&J's brand. The product we were going to make was to say tear-free formula instead of the more familiar no more tears. Going over an analysis of the shampoo sample we created, the customer complained that pH levels were too low. Chemists use pH to measure the acidity or alkalinity of a solution. The scale runs from 1 to 14, with a measure of 7 representing neutral. The first sample had come in with a reading that was closer to 6, which suggested that the shampoo would be too acidic. In other words, it would lead to tears. Hearing this, a Johnson Carter representative was upset, and I got a note from New York asking me why the factory was now cheating us out of pH, as if it were an ingredient that the factory was cutting a corner on. Johnson Carter cared about catching orders, and retailers cared almost exclusively about not getting into any trouble. No one ever remarked on the product itself. They never asked if it was any good. I doubted that anyone at ShopCorp had ever personally tried the product. I once asked Bernie if he had ever tried our discount shampoo himself, and he shot me a look that said, "What, are you nuts?" One of our products was a blue formulation called Milk and Aloe. Janet, at ShopCorp, noticed that the ingredients list did not include the chemical name for aloe. We had been selling the product for some time, and she was the only customer who had ever made an issue about any missing aloe ingredient. Janet said some would need to be added. "How much?" I asked Bernie. In a tone that suggested the answer was obvious, he said just enough to justify putting the ingredient on the label. I asked whether Janet might later suggest that we also needed to add milk to Milk and Aloe. Bernie told me not to bring it up, that we would deal with it only if ShopCorp raised the issue. Eventually, they did. Janet said that we needed to justify anything printed on the label. It was, she said, what the FDA was most concerned about when it came to health and beauty care products, making sure that the labels were all compliant. "We don't expect fresh milk, of course," she said, while not indicating how we might justify the word milk on the packaging. Janet sent over a large document that she had found on the FDA's website. She remained unclear on a number of labeling issues. Reading the document myself, I could not find answers to certain questions, and no one at Johnson Carter was of much help either. Janet wanted the labels to match the ingredients exactly, but did not know the guidelines. I pointed out that we had a bubble bath called Bursting Bubblegum, which had no bubblegum in it. Our bottle labeled Galaxy Grape didn't have grapes either. Hearing these points, she became flustered. She did not know what to do or think. There wasn't anyone in the business, the manufacturer, the importer, or the retailer, that knew how to address these ingredients concerns. One of Johnson Carter's best-selling items was a body wash that came in a tall, monster-sized bottle. Several days before a truck was scheduled to pick up a large order of the body wash, I noticed many of the bottles had not been filled completely. Sister came over and inspected them. She said that it was a common occurrence, caused by air in the formulation. When the liquid settled, the fill level dropped a little. She insisted that the bottles had all been properly full at the time they were capped. While what she said made sense, I noted that we did not have the same settling problem with the regular-sized bottles of shampoo and bubble bath. In any case, I suggested, it did not matter how we had come to have an issue with fill levels, either way, we had a problem. It was not just a matter of aesthetics, but it also involved labeling compliance. If we said that there were 850 milliliters of product in the bottle, we had to have that much in it. The shampoo could be low quality, there just had to be as much of the product there as we claimed there was. There was another reason to fix the problem. A retailer might use the fill level issue against us. If the product was not selling well, for instance, the retailer could tell Johnson Carter that it needed to pull the product, using the fill issue as an excuse. Because Johnson Carter bore all of the financial risk, it had to insist that the product be made properly. We measured the amount of body wash that was in the bottles, and it came up short of the 850 milliliters advertised on the label. Sister promised that it would never happen again, and that she wanted to ship the product anyway. I suggested that we fill only those bottles that were obviously too low. "It is too inconvenient," she said. She intimated that it would cause her embarrassment, and I took it to mean that she might personally suffer some kind of face loss. If she had purposefully shorted some of the bottles to save a small amount of money, maybe it was the backfiring of her plan that stung. In any case, Sister suggested that it would be rude to reject the order. It was already packaged and ready to ship. "It was an honest mistake," she said. "It could have happened to anyone. And anyway, it wouldn't happen again. For the sake of our cooperation," she said, "please try to understand." This sort of scenario happened all the time. Factories created a quality problem and turned it into a hot potato for importers by asking them to assume all risks. Though King Chemical had caused the problem, it suggested that Johnson Carter should be sensitive to its situation. Manufacturers that engaged in the manipulation of quality knew that if they were caught, there was an inclination to work things out. In this way, manufacturers came to view the idea of saving face as a get-out-of-jail-free card. Knowing that an importer was disinclined to cause loss of face for the manufacturer actually encouraged production shenanigans in the first place. I tried to reason with Sister. "In the United States, there are rules," I said. "Confucianism taught respect for guidelines, just as it placed a value on face." "You're just saying that," she said. We discussed the possibility of filling the bottles, and the more it looked as though I would not back down on the suggestion to fix the problem, the angrier she became. At one point, she suggested that I would have to take responsibility for my actions. It was a threat, a suggestion that any consequence of pressing the issue would be of my own making. When threatening me failed to produce the desired outcome, her demeanor changed, and she turned on the charm. Trying her best to appear beguiling, she flattered me. "Please speak with Bernie tonight," she said. "Tell him that it's not so bad. He listens to you. He will probably have the same thing to say. Tell him that it won't happen again." She reached out and touched my sleeve. I told her that I would speak to Bernie, but I told her not to hold out too much hope. The issue of filling the bottles did not seem like a big deal. It might have taken a day to fix, two at the most, but there was a sense that this issue was about something else. In export manufacturing, you didn't always get all the information you needed. All that I knew was that Sister was desperate not to rework the body wash and that the issue was serious enough that she was alternatively making threats and pleading with me. "It's simple," Bernie said when I got him on the phone that evening. "If the bottles are not filled, you can't ship them." "I know." "Then what's the goddamn problem over there?" Working as a go-between was a tricky business. Chinese have worked with intermediaries throughout their long history, and if they thought someone in the middle was an obstacle to greater profitability, they would get him out of the picture. You couldn't be at the factory, play things hard, and expect to accomplish everything you wished. What seemed to be an easy fix, topping off a number of bottles that came in underfilled, was to Sister either a much bigger job than it seemed to be, or else it was truly a matter of personal embarrassment. I'm not sure what this situation is about, I told Bernie, but for some reason, they want us to give them a break. Give them a break, he said, sounding incredulous. Listen to him. He wants me to give them a break. Bernie had a tendency, like other importers, to take the contractual view. When he placed orders, he wanted a precise result based on expectations. As a customer, he was entitled to certain things, and I understood what he was trying to do. By playing tough on this smaller issue, what he was really hoping to do was prevent the manufacturer from delivering an even bigger problem down the road. You don't understand something, he said. If you give these people an inch, they'll take a mile. At the factory the next day, I passed along the bad news. Bernie wanted the bottles filled. Sister was upset, and there was nothing to do since Bernie had made the call. Sister took a couple dozen workers from the plant, and a makeshift production line was set up in the warehouse. Cardboard boxes of body wash were opened, and bottles that were not full were topped off. It was a slow process, and Sister turned cool toward me. Typically, someone at the factory drove me back to the hotel because there was no taxi service near the factory in the countryside. When it was getting close to the time for me to head back, I asked about my ride. Sister said that her driver was indisposed. What about one of the delivery drivers then? I asked. They have things to do, she said. We are very busy. I saw two delivery trucks parked in the lot out front. Even if the drivers were busy, there was usually someone coming or going who would offer to give me a lift into town. I had been to the factory many times, but this was the first time that anyone told me there was no transportation. After waiting an hour by the lot where the cars were parked, I went to find Sister. She was in her office. She seemed to anticipate my return. Her arms were folded, and she looked smug. I asked her again about the possibility of a ride. We have done as you asked, she said. The bottles are all filled now. I walked out of the factory on my own and set out down the country road that connected the remote factory to the rest of the world. Some workers standing outside the factory saw me and laughed. Walking down the quiet path alone, I probably looked to them like a down-and-out migrant worker from the provinces. Eventually, I found a lift. I flagged down a motorcycle taxi, one of those sorry vehicles that was just a wooden frame box attached to the back half of a motorcycle. These three-wheeled death traps had no windows, and even the locals used them only as a last resort. The message from the factory was clear in any case. You either work with us, or we can make things difficult. An importer should have been rewarded for uncovering quality problems, but it was almost never the case. Factories did not see an attention to quality as something that would improve their business prospects, but merely as a barrier to increased profitability. Working to achieve higher levels of quality did not make me a friend of the factory, but a pariah. Importers learned quickly that improved quality raised their costs. Every time Johnson Carter managed to find a problem and asked the factory to correct it, the factory shifted the cost back to us. Over the long run, when an importer was seen as working too hard to improve quality, it was viewed as a meddlesome customer, and other buyers by comparison appeared more attractive. Manufacturers preferred their importers to be meek and acquiescent. There were others like me in China, foreigners who went into factories on behalf of importers to fight for quality improvements. And it was at times a comfort to know that I did not suffer these challenges alone. I met one such individual who worked with a big network of suppliers. His company was based in Shanghai, though they had offices throughout South China as well. I asked about his quality challenge. We don't have any problems, he said in a flat tone. You don't have any? I asked. It was hard to believe, especially since everyone else reported having them. I asked how it was possible. Easy, he said. We have 90 quality control inspectors on the ground. They had no quality problems. That's why they deployed a battalion of inspectors. What made the situation in China so bizarre was that manufacturers themselves all had their own quality control staff, workers who stood on the assembly lines marked products as QC passed or quality control OK. They were good at applying the stickers, but foreign firms still found that they needed to send in their own inspectors. If ever there was any indicator that there was a problem with China Inc., this was it. Huge numbers of people were hired and paid to do the job that manufacturers were either unable or unwilling to do for themselves. An entire industry was cropping up of third-party inspectors, and some of these companies had veritable armies on the ground, trained as quality control mercenaries. Why couldn't these Chinese manufacturers do the job themselves? Why did they require so much oversight? The day after I had been told to find my own ride back to the hotel, I expected the cold shoulder from Sister. Instead, it was as if the incident had never occurred. There was no lingering resentment. No one offered me any sort of apology, and at the same time, no one seemed to expect one from me either. This was one of the things I found hard to explain about factory owners, how they could make such displays of emotion one moment and then put aside those feelings entirely the next. The body wash shipped out that week, and attention was immediately turned to other orders in process. Everything seemed all right, but then the factory made a surprise announcement. It would no longer accept orders for body wash from Johnson Carter. Sister explained that she would make all of our other products, but the body wash was too problematic, as we had all already seen. "They can't do that to me," Bernie said. "Tell them that they have to make the body wash. Tell them that I said that." The idea of making some of our product in one place and the rest in another was absurd. For shipping reasons alone, it would have been too inefficient. Transportation costs would go up, and then production schedules would suffer delays from coordination issues. The factory had succeeded in making its point, and we were reduced to begging the factory to keep making the body wash. Sister eventually acquiesced, but not before emphasizing that she hoped we would never run into the same problem again with Johnson Carter making similar demands about fill levels. This was a problem that many importers faced. The more they pushed for quality, the harder their suppliers pushed back. Following the body wash incident, the relationship grew more difficult. I asked Sister when I could inspect the next shipment and was told to come on a Friday. When I arrived on the appointed morning, I was informed that they had already shipped the product 2 days earlier. For a moment, I thought I was being told that the product would leave 2 days later. In Mandarin, the day before yesterday was translated as the day in front, qian tian, and the day after tomorrow was the day in back, hou tian. In Chinese, the speaker faced the past while keeping his back to the future, and the backwards view always left me mixed up. "You sent the product out the day before yesterday and did not think to mention it?" "We did not want to bother you," Sister said. The factory had managed to score a 2 for 4 for itself. Product that couldn't be inspected suffered no risk of rejection, and at the same time, Sister succeeded in making me look ineffective. "How could you let them do that to you?" Bernie asked me. The reality was that these small stunts could not be prevented, and that none of the tricks that went on were enough to seriously consider switching to another supplier. Contract manufacturing was not like buying fruit, where if you didn't like the goods at one shop, you simply walked across the street to a competitor's. Supplier relationships took a great deal of effort to set up, and it took a long time to work out the kinks. Outsourced manufacturing was a bit like marriage in some ways. Even when things got rocky, it generally made more sense to work things out than to leave in the hope of finding a better partner elsewhere. Johnson Carter's solution to some of the hide-and-seek games was to initiate surprise inspections. Bernie's feeling was that if the factory were hiding any quality problems, inspections at unexpected times would make them easier to find. Bernie announced that, as a representative of his company, I would now be making random visits. No advanced warning of my arrival would be given, and the factory was to ensure that its doors were open at all times. It seemed demanding and a bit presumptuous, and I thought that the factory might protest the move as insulting. Quite the opposite, Sister seemed surprised that it had taken so long for us to become so vigilant. Bernie took an unusual approach to such inspections. He would randomly announce to factory reps that I would visit on a particular day, just to gauge their reaction. If the factory reps offered no protest about the visit, he would cancel the trip, figuring that there must be nothing interesting to see. Alternatively, if anyone at the factory hinted that some days might be inconvenient, I was to rush to the factory during that time. During one of these suggested blackout periods, I flew into Shanto and arrived only to find that our product was not in process, that we had almost no finished product in the warehouse to inspect, and that Sister was out of town on business. In other words, it was a wasted trip. Johnson Carter was shipping increasingly large volumes of product when a bad piece of news came in. A major customer complained that our bottles were being made too thin. The factory had quietly adjusted the molds so that less plastic went into making each bottle. As a result, when a bottle was given the slightest squeeze, it collapsed. "It's a goddamn plastic bag," Bernie complained. After an investigation, his office in New York discovered that the bottle had gone through more than one change. The factory had been making downward adjustments over a several-month period. The first bottles that came off the line were sturdy, but then they came out as merely acceptable. When none of us noticed the earlier changes, the factory decided to go for it again. Chinese factories often engaged in this sort of quality fade, the incremental degradation of a product over time. They quietly reduced the amount of materials or else manipulated the quality of raw inputs. The changes were gradual, almost imperceptible. The importer was neither asked for permission nor told. Even more galling for Johnson Carter in the case of the plastic bottles was that it had paid for and legally owned the molds that the factory had been manipulating. Putting less plastic into the bottles generated savings, but these were not shared with the importer. The only thing passed on to the importer was an increase in product risk. King Chemical had turned the business into a game. The terms of each deal were negotiated at the start of the project, and then the factory went on a hunt, looking for savings. Bernie's earlier question about the business, how can the factory quote such a low price, was now at least partially answered. Our job in the cat-and-mouse game that the factory had set up was to discover where the product was being manipulated. If we found the distortion, the factory might be convinced to revert to the original design. If we failed to uncover its scheme, the factory pocketed the savings. In any case, it was left for us to do the uncovering. The factory gained sometimes, but it never lost. Johnson Carter was not purchasing a ready-made product, but a product that was made to order. The importer provided all the package designs, including bottle samples. The factory's decision to make the bottles thinner was made unilaterally. The manufacturer issued no if-then conditional clause like, "If you refuse to pay us more, then we will deliver an inferior product." They just went ahead with it, and far from hinting that we should expect a poor product because we were paying lower prices, the factory actually guaranteed that its product would be better than what we would find at any of its competitors. That guarantee was actually met in the first order or two, but thereafter, quality went downhill. Quality fade was an economic decision that manufacturers in China made. It was a calculated risk, and in the back of the factory owner's mind was always a plan B. If the importer found out that the factory owner had been manipulating quality and the shipment was rejected, just where would that product then be sold? Even 10 years earlier, there was more risk in manipulating quality because there was nowhere for a manufacturer to dump a shipment that had been rejected. In more recent years, China found itself at a crossroads for international trade. If we rejected a large shipment of our shampoo, there were agents who would help move the product out of the country into one of many growing export markets. And even the domestic market had developed to the point where an agent might be able to find buyers of surplus inside China. One of the many reasons that quality problems were on the rise was because of the increase in salvage opportunities. Knowing that there was somewhere to dump product from a quality manipulation plan gone awry actually helped increase the likelihood of product shenanigans. China manufacturing had no concept of punitive damages or penalties for bad behavior, which was another contributing factor. If, or rather when, the factory was caught in some scheme to manipulate product quality, the only thing that the factory could be expected to do was remake the product properly. The importer would never be reimbursed for damages arising from a loss of business or reputation. The only cost to the factory for getting caught with their hand in the cookie jar was being made to put the lid back on the jar. Because King Chemical blamed its suppliers for certain instances of quality fade, Bernie suggested that we meet with some of the companies that provided the factory with key inputs. He wanted to start with the supplier responsible for the bottles that had been made too thin. The factory, however, did not want to set up the meeting. They did not want us gathering information from their supplier because the information might contradict what the factory claimed regarding their cost structure. A sub-supplier might also possibly tip us off to another factory that was equally or more capable than King Chemical. After repeated requests, the factory finally arranged a meeting for Bernie on one of his visits. We were brought to the bottle factory, but learned after the visit that it had only been a red herring. The supplier we met with might have been speaking with King Chemical about the prospect of supplying bottles, but they were not the actual supplier of the bottles in question. Factory owners were often in cahoots with one another anyway, and even more so when it came to a scheme involving a foreign client. If one industrialist asked another for help, the favor was granted with the understanding that it would later be repaid. Bernie tried to hold back orders until the bottle supplier was identified, but the pressure to get more merchandise produced became too great, and the idea was eventually dropped. Johnson Carter placed more orders, and we continued to ship more merchandise made at King Chemical.